Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. We have four cases on our oral calendar today. This is the third one, A24-0458, State of Minnesota versus Robert Allen Bennett. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial oral arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant if you so choose. This is being live streamed and being recorded. No other recordings are permitted of this proceeding. The podium has a button underneath to lower and raise it to your height, and you can also move the microphone as well so that we can hear your arguments clearly. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin your argument, and please state your name for the record and party you are representing.
May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherman County attorney, and I appear on behalf of appellant of the state of Minnesota. The record in this case does not show that Mr. Bennett is particularly amenable to probation, and because of this, the district court lacked the discretion to depart from the sentencing guidelines. This court should reverse that stayed sentence and remand with instruction to execute the guideline sentence. I welcome the court's questions.
Counsel, it seems like there's a pretty extensive record here of support for this person, and even defense counsel at the hearings acknowledged that while defense counsel normally was fairly jaded, that the appellant here, Mr. Bennett, really seemed to undergo a change here, unlike others, including undertaking mental health treatment, which often is the underlying issue when somebody engages in substance use. Further, you had the record of, I believe it was about 23 letters of recommendation that were written on behalf of appellant, including from his mother, including from his daughter, people throughout the community. That seems like a pretty extensive record, and I feel like I just kind of scratched the surface here. Why isn't that enough to support the district court's decision to grant that departure?
For two reasons. First, the majority of those letters came from family and friends that existed long before this offense occurred. They existed, and when he had these prior legal issues, they knew about his alcohol issues and his mental health issues, and they weren't enough to intervene and avoid this sort of incident. So the district court...
Right, but that's what occurred in the past, and he readily acknowledged that the other times he still struggled with his alcohol use, and the family and friends, including his immediate family, also readily acknowledged that he still struggled, and it wasn't until this most recent incident that he was really able to deal with and address and acknowledge the challenges that he had faced.
And I think that what happened here is that the district court did not put weight in that previously existing support network because it had not benefited him around this time. It hadn't been enough to
right.
stave off this sort
right.
of issue.
But he had been under court supervision for 18 months.
Correct.
That's a pretty extensive amount of time. We've affirmed cases in which a person has only been under court supervision of 6 months, and the district court has said, it looks like this person is turning their life around and is actually on the right track. There seems to be fairly extensive evidence in this record over a year and a half that he has indeed changed his life and what he's done and is indeed addressing the issues that we hope as a society people can address in this situation.
Well, and that's where we get to the second part about that support network that he had. The supports that he gained, and I acknowledge that he gained some supports going through the pretrial process and those treatment programs that he got himself into. But when we actually got to the point of sentencing and that pre-sentence investigation, he had completed the actual chemical dependency treatment process that he was doing. He was down to individual therapy, and he told the pre-sentence investigation interviewer that he wasn't planning on continuing with that much farther after the sentencing date. So that support network may have been there to support him, but he was not invested in relying on that support network after the point of sentencing. So it...
I'm not sure the record supports that, with all due respect, counsel, because he has a support network through I think it's the AA group, that he is supporting other people as well as being supported by a sponsor, by attending the AA meetings. And even the district court said, you know, you need to continue on, including with the program that you had just mentioned. So,
correct. The district court said that you have to continue on with this because he was not volunteering to continue on with it. It required a court order to continue with that individual therapy until there was a recommendation from the therapist to discontinue it, and a court order to attend AA meetings as part of his probation. So there's nothing in the record to indicate that he was planning on continuing with those supports, with that treatment, after the sentencing date. And at that point, there's no treatment program that is being supervised for probation, so I don't see how that fits with particular amenability to some sort of treatment program in a probationary sentence. It would have just been, for him, essentially a little bit more than administrative probation with no use in random testing, if he had actually gotten what he thought was appropriate for him.
Other than that point, what else in the record shows that this person is not particularly amenable to probation?
I think his prior record shows that he's not particularly amenable to probation, and I recognize that the prior interventions did not include a mental health component, but we do have that 2005 treatment episode that was related to work. In the respondent's brief, they indicate that it was related to he stopped getting paid, so he stopped doing it. I didn't see any support from that in the record. It said that there was a job loss and he discontinued treatment. There was the 2008 DWI, so there was another opportunity to address his chemical use issues at that point. And then that 2017 DWI probation, where he even acknowledged that his sobriety only lasted a few months. So this is a situation where he's gone through multiple iterations of treatment and has not learned the lessons from those treatment programs, and instead has returned to the problem behavior shortly after supervision ends or shortly after the programming ends.
Counsel, we've seen many of these cases, and my esteemed colleagues have seen even more than I have, because both of them sat on the district court, which I did not do. So I know they have even more experience than I do, but in my 10 plus years here on the Court of Appeals, I have seen a lot of these, and it's pretty apparent that a lot of these people that struggle with substance abuse, including alcohol use, relapses are very common. And treatment often doesn't take the first time, second time, third time, even 10th time. It seems to have taken here with this person. At what stage does a person have to pay for the crimes that they've committed in the past in terms of not being able to go through successfully treatment when there's evidence in the record of their current treatment and their current success and their current acknowledgement of the issues that they face and need to address?
I think it would have been a different situation here if Mr. Bennett had shown up for sentencing with a specific plan of the continuing programming that he wanted to do to treat himself instead of acting as a support for others. I think that's admirable, but I don't think it really goes to whether he is particularly amenable to treatment. And then also, instead of having an equivocal approach to continuing with the therapy that he was engaged in, a more aggressive or open mindset to continuing with that mental health therapy that he was doing. I think if he'd come into sentencing showing that he had a plan to continue and voicing how that plan fit with probation, this would be a different situation.
Mr. Kennedy, as counsel for respondent probably knows well, she's typically on that side of the room, and we apply an abuse of discretion, and more often than not, most often than not, we affirm a denial of a departure as long as the judge considered the factors you know, seriously considered the motion and all the facts that would have supported and simply declined. And oftentimes, Judge Reyes says, we might talk in our conference, well, I probably would have given a departure, but that's not our role. This is the flip-flop, and it strikes me that, you know, your arguments today and your briefing, you simply disagree with the ultimate conclusion. There's not much dispute about the facts. So in other words, you're disputing whether he's really serious about treatment this time or he's really serious about his mental illness treatment. What makes this different than our typical denial of an appeal of a denial of a departure when the judge obviously considered it, listened to it, listened to the arguments I'm assuming you made today to the district court, but granted a departure?
Well, one difference is that departures are supposed to be the exception and not the rule. And I'm not suggesting that this was a case where the district court prejudged and came in with a departure already planned out. I think that the court did consider the arguments at sentencing. But there were some, the state believes that there were some legal issues along the way, going through the factors. The district court talked about criminal history. According to State v. Soto, even a minor criminal history is supposed to weigh against a departure. Here, it looks like there was some sort of consideration of it, but these two prior DWIs, according to Soto, should have been weighed against probation unless there was a showing that he's able to succeed with probationary treatment. I don't think we have that here because on that most recent term of probation, he failed to maintain sobriety for more than 3 or 4 months.
And you're talking about the 2008?
No, the 2017.
17, okay.
Yeah, the one that he was discharged from probation about 3 months before committing this offense.
But in this case, you had a much longer period of sobriety at the time of sentencing than 4 months. I mean, it was 14, wasn't it?
What I just said was that there was, he maintained sobriety for 4 months.
After the second DWI offense.
After he completed treatment programming.
Correct.
So there has been some time, there's been more time that's passed than that, yes.
Well, was that a 30-day treatment program or?
The treatment program that he did.
The second time.
The second time, in this case?
Yeah. I mean, usually treatment's 30 days, at least if it's inpatient.
I do not have that information. The information from Community Corrections is that it was through Nystrom and Associates. So we did not get the actual treatment documents. Additionally, the court looked at cooperation and attitude in court as a single factor. I think that those are supposed to be split out looking at how the TROG factors are worded. And here, he acted appropriately in court. He did the things that he was expected to do. He's gone above and beyond in some ways with that treatment that he did. And the steps that he's taken to try to become a counselor. But there's also a very strong record that he did not cooperate here. Just the underlying facts of this case where he pulled a handgun during an interaction with an officer to get away from that interaction, fled, and then engaged in a standoff that led a considerable amount of time. I think that it was a legal error to weigh cooperation in his favor. And then we've previously talked about community support and how, based on his own statements, he wasn't engaged. I don't dispute that people were there to support him, but looking at his statements in the pre-sentence investigation, it's not clear, and I think that it was error to conclude that he had accepted that support and was engaged in it.
But isn't that example where you just disagree? There's facts that might go both way, but the point being, as long as the court considered his affidavit, his statement, his testimony at the plea and sentencing, that he's regretful, he's remorseful, he apologized to the deputy that very evening, isn't the point being, as long as the judge pointed to one of the TROG factors in support, though you might disagree, and even if we might disagree, that's not an abuse of discretion.
Again, I think that I don't think the record supports the district court's conclusion on the support element, because there are the letters in the record, but we also have Mr. Bennett's own statement that he was not planning on continuing to use that support going forward with probation. But at the end of the day, this is a case about whether he was a good fit for treatment. And here we did not have a structured treatment plan going forward. It was going to be individual therapy as long as the therapist recommended that, and twice weekly AA meetings. So I don't think that that shows that there is a particularized specific treatment plan in place for him that is going to be enough to show that should have satisfied the court for this. We ask the court to reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning. My name is Laura Heinrich. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the respondent in this case, Robert Bennett. As this court has already discussed, the district court has broad discretion in determining the appropriate sentence and whether a departure is appropriate. The district court is in the best position to determine that appropriate sentence. This court should only reverse if there was not facts in the record to support the district court's decision to grant probation in this case. And as it's already been discussed this morning, this record is replete with facts that support the district court's decision. There was a lot of discussion about the community support that Mr. Bennett has. And I wanted to add some to that discussion here. First, I would note that in the number of letters from his family that are there before, they all described not the same relationship that they had with him, that he wasn't reclusive the way he had used to be, that he wasn't isolating himself like he used to be. He was all of a sudden joyful and calling them and being very open about his process, and he was engaged in a way he had never been engaged before. So even though these people had been in his life, some for 30 plus years, he was engaged with them in a different way than he had been engaged previously. He was using his support, they were recognizing that, and they were stepping up to be there for him. I would also note that he had different people in his life to support him, including his counselor, who showed up at the sentencing hearing and who talked about the fact that he was going to AA meetings and continuing to be part of the community in that way. He had the certified peer specialist that had worked with him when he was in treatment, who was there to support him, not just through letters, but being there in the courtroom with him. And he also was engaged with his therapist, which he had done for almost 16 months of therapy. And it wasn't that he was saying he didn't want to do it anymore. It's that he had already reaped the benefits. He wasn't discontinuing this relationship because he felt that he was now going to be sentenced and be on probation, didn't need to do it. It's that he's already experienced what he needed to experience of addressing the trauma from his childhood and the abuse that he'd experienced.
But then why not wait until the therapist says you're ready to go?
He was happy to do that. He wasn't identifying anything that he would continue to work on. He had said that he had experienced all these benefits. You know, it's the relationship he's having with his therapist, who said in the letter that he's happy to accommodate anything she asks, that he's happy to engage. And had she said, I think you need to continue to be involved in and mental health treatment, there's nothing to suggest he would have said no. It's just he wasn't seeing anything additional to work on. He was talking less in therapy because he had less to say, because he had already started to feel the benefits and was utilizing the tools that they had put in place.
It seems that a pretty strong argument can be made that based on the record, he was amenable to probation, but, you know, it seems this word particularly means it should really be a rare event when a person enjoys a dispositional departure for this reason. And is there any standards that we can apply to what particularly means?
Well,
that are more objective than subjective?
I think that there's a tension there, because when you're looking at whether someone is particularly amenable to probation, you're supposed to look at their individual characteristics, mm-hmm. what's happening with this person. So there is a specificity and subjectivity there because you're dealing with a specific person with a specific history with specific issues to work on. There isn't really this objective standard. Ultimately, in Soto, when the Minnesota Supreme Court was talking about what does particular mean, they're looking at a dictionary definition. So they're adding additional facts like, or additional words such as specific or exceptional. And I think Mr. Bennett actually embodies both of those things in this particular case. I'm not sure what else defense attorney could have provided or Mr. Bennett could have done to make himself stand out. Dealing with a traumatic abuse of childhood and dealing with his addiction and dealing with his sort of social isolation, dealing with the fact that he had gone from being a person who was employed with the union for however many years to now being disabled, finding a new hope in life, finding a way to engage that's meaningful, including serving other people through working at the food shelf, through being part of the treatment community, wanting to be the person that other people who are experiencing dual diagnosis treatment as they come out of treatment, he's there for them as a mentor, as a guide, as an advocate. Those things are particularly amenable to probation type of things you can point out about Mr. Bennett. And I think because it is an individualized, which is what the district court judge talked about in deciding to grant the departure, she first talks about that we're not talking about a category of crimes here. We're talking about you. Let's look at what you're doing and whether or not that warrants a dispositional departure. And that is what has to happen in thinking about the individual characteristics of this particular person at sentencing.
Don't you have the problem here? You can't ignore the underlying factual basis for the assault and the second degree crime. And that involved a relapse and then a fairly dramatic criminal behavior. What's going to happen the next time he relapses?
Well, first I would like to put what happened in context. I guess before I put what happens in context, you always have the possibility of relapse. I mean, that just is the reality of addiction. As the court has already talked about here today, people struggle over their lifetime with addiction. It is a daily decision to not use again. However, he has everything in place to make sure that he makes the right decision because he has all of these people in his life, these communities he's engaged in, the tools internally to think about how to change his mindset. I mean, his affidavit was really compelling about I wake up and I find gratitude. The first thing I do every morning is identify three things, no matter how small, that I'm grateful for. But talking about the behavior, I disagree with the state's depiction of what happened on that particular night. There's a lot of talking about a standoff or displaying his gun at the officer. I would first note this is not a first-degree assault. There's no brandishing. There's no charge at any time that was a first-degree assault. Secondly, he, at the time, never pointed the gun at the officer. It's very clear. Even on that evening, talked to the officer about he understands how his behavior could have scared him. He didn't ever mean to hurt him. He was incredibly apologetic. He was going through essentially a suicide attempt. After he had lost his job for about 2 months, he had this relapse. He hadn't dealt with his mental health or depression. This had a very unique set of circumstances. The standoff involved him walking to his garage door, putting in the code, going inside with the gun by his side, not holding it up, not pointing it at anyone, and then having his brother call to talk him out of killing himself and to coming out and apologizing to the officers. Sort of it's not your typical second degree assault. I think it arises out of a unique set of circumstances in his life at the time that were overwhelming without the tools to deal with them clearly.
But less threatening behavior with a person who had a permit to carry a gun didn't keep Philando Castro alive, did it? Whatever. You know the case I'm referring to.
I do.
Same thing, permit to carry, discloses it to the officer. He hadn't even been drinking, apparently. He ends up dead. I mean, so if you have a relapse and you're going to be wandering around with guns, it could be a very dangerous situation for you or those around you.
Well, Your Honor, for Mr. Bennett specifically, he's never going to be able to have a gun again going forward by statute.
Not legally, but...
Right, but there's no, there's nothing to suggest that he is running around doing anything other than drinking and making and driving. There's no criminal history that includes any type of violence whatsoever here. You have a misdemeanor DUI and then a gross misdemeanor DUI. You don't have him engaging. And in fact, you have a number of letters of support from family that talk about the fact that they never see him with a gun. He doesn't even go hunting anymore. They were surprised that he had a gun at all. So I don't think we have anything specific to Mr. Bennett to fear that he's going to be in a position where he's illegally obtaining a gun, especially a person who has been law-abiding in every other way and working his entire career and raising a daughter.
But the problem is if he relapses, everything kind of goes out the window. And he was willing to violate his permit by possessing his pistol when he was impaired on the night that this happened. So if he's impaired again, why would we think he's not capable of doing other things that are concerning, at least in the facts of this case and based on his behavior on that night?
Well, if I could circle back to the standard here, we have ultimately a district court judge who's in court with somebody able to evaluate their behavior, their sincerity. We haven't talked a lot about it this morning, but remorse, the incredible remorse that he showed, and I would note that the state seems to think that it needs to be remarkable remorse before that's a valid basis for a departure. There's nothing in the case law that says remarkable. And the district court was able to see his demeanor, read his words, hear how he was talking. Remorse is one of those indicators that you're going to do well going forward. I mean, ultimately, the case law supports that it becomes a motivator to comply with probation, to continue with doing all of the good things in your life. It's clear that he is incredibly grateful, not only to the officers who were there that night, but to the court system generally, for essentially intervening. And he feels accountable to them. He said thank you more times than I've ever heard a client in my entire career say in the course of this case from the plea hearing onward. And you can tell he's talking about it with his family because it's in the letters that they wrote as well. They were grateful to the officers. They had had conversations with him about how grateful they all were to the officers. So you have a lot of things in place here that cut against relapse, also tools he can reach out to deal with relapse that he didn't have before, and ultimately you have remorse as a motivating factor for him to continue to go forward doing the right thing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the district court say that his age cut against him in this?
He did it. The district court did say that. That was
the
one.
Doesn't the case law say that age is a nebulous thing and it can go either way? Am I off on that?
You're not off on that. I would say that the case law generally talks about youthful indiscretions as being a reason to have a departure. But the other argument is that if you see people who are in their latter 50s, he's 57 years old, you're often outside of the range of individuals that you're...
But doesn't the fact that he's lived 57 years and really not gotten into anything dramatically violent before, at least. It seems like he had two DWIs, which, you know, in the counties I work in, that's kind of normal for most guys 30 or above. At any rate, it seems like in this case, to me, it's a factor that really favors him rather than disfavoring him. He's led a life where he hasn't bumped into the law that much, at least in the kinds of things we worry about, an armed robbery or burglary or whatever, you know.
I would agree, and it's in the record. It's sort of another support, even if the judge didn't explicitly rely on that. I would also note that at every single one of the letters talked about that he has no violent history whatsoever. Nobody had ever seen him be violent at any time.
Well, and it, you know, it appears from the facts that this, because of his despair maybe over getting pulled over for another DWI, became a potential suicide by cop. I mean, that's the way I read it, having dealt with law enforcement since the 70s. And that seems to be what was maybe a big part of the court's decision, I would think.
The court is... clearly talks about the steps that he's made and the mental health interventions as being something that makes him particularly amenable. You know, it's not just the mental health piece that he's addressing. It's also finding the right counselor and the right community. And that was something he addressed in his letter, is that he really felt that his counselor and treatment was somebody he understood and opened up to and felt like this was the right fit for him.
One thing that struck me as odd is why was it outpatient treatment, given his history?
You know, I have seen a lot of Rule 25s in my experience, but I'm not a professional in terms of evaluation. It's what it was ultimately, the type of treatment that he was recommended to do. And he clearly took advantage of that. And then he also added the mental health component, where he was meeting with his therapist every week as well. So I can't really speak to why, but it clearly was effective. So just to recap, ultimately the standard here is that the record has to support what the district court found. There's nothing about this record that doesn't support what the district court found. In fact, some of the language in the state's brief about how these are assumptions, they're actually facts. They're facts that are there that the judge could rely on. So for all those reasons, the district court's departure should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Bennett may have said thank you more times than could be counted, but he also told the PSI investigator that he had no problem areas that he would like help working on if placed on probation. So this is not a situation where he was looking forward to and had a plan to continue with ongoing treatment. He didn't show a insight into the needs that he had for ongoing treatment, and because of that, it was error to conclude that he was particularly amenable to probation. We asked the court to. Oh, yes.
Counselor, are you familiar with the HOPE program in Hawaii and programs like it? It's part of the model penal code now, I think.
The which program?
HOPE.
I'm afraid.
It's the Hawaii program. It's kind of the cutting edge of what became the model penal code, I think. But what it stands for and what I gleaned from that when I was a district court judge and, you know, the Court of Appeals, is sometimes we put all these conditions on people, which just sets them up for failure, because that's what we do. We put conditions on people, and we don't take the kind of look at someone that we probably need to do. We just kind of rotely, this crime is going to get these 8 conditions, especially when we're talking about chemical crimes. And, you know, he may have been right when he's telling us that there's nothing else that's going to provide me with any other benefit here. It's up to me to prove that I can do it. Wouldn't that be a somewhat reasonable position at this point? He's not saying he won't do it. He's just saying, I don't think I need to do it.
Again, I think that shows a lack of insight in the process that is recovery, because we've already talked about how relapse is part of recovery and that this is a long process. For him, it's...
But isn't that AA and having a sponsor and all those kinds of things?
It is, but he did not affirmatively have a plan to continue with that. It was conditions that the district court had to order for him to have ongoing treatment of any sort.
Wasn't his plan to implement the treatment that he had already gone through for the 16 or 18 months that he had been under the district court supervision, including the therapy that he had gone through, the AA, and with AA, it's you take each day as it comes. And each day, you choose that you're not going to relapse. You choose that you're not going to drink. You choose that you're going to show gratitude, and you choose that you're going to be, take positive steps. Why isn't that a plan? That's part of the AA plan of you take each day as it comes.
It is part of the plan, but he did not show up with that plan spelled out. So I think that I agree that it's that sometimes the district courts saddle people going on probation with an insurmountable number of conditions. But here, if he was trying to show that he was particularly amenable to probation, he needed to have a plan of this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to tackle the issues that I have.
What case law do you rely on that when we are looking at the TROG factors, it is required that a person have a written plan as to what they're going to do to address their issues?
I'm not saying that it has to be a written plan. And regarding the TROG factors, those are factors that are helpful to consider, but they are not essential. The overall concern is whether someone
is... What do you mean they're not essential? Because aren't district courts supposed to consider the TROG factors when we're looking at whether to grant a downward dispositional factor under SOTO? It's certainly not an exclusive list. The
right.
Supreme Court has made clear it's not exclusive, but certainly those are factors that it just
wouldn't
look at.
The way that I have seen it described is that they are factors that are helpful to consider in that evaluation, but they are not exclusive, and you do not need to find all of them. The point that I was making is if the overall question is whether he is particularly amenable to a treatment plan, he should have shown up with more of a plan in place than I don't think I have anything that I need to address, if he even wanted to show amenability to probation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. We will issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.